Good afternoon. Welcome to Week in Review. I'm Kim Malcolm. Bill Radke is back next week. Coming up, we're talking about equal pay. We ask again, should we bring in an income tax in this state? And we'll take a look at the Mariners, if our nerves can handle it. Joining me to talk about it all is Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail. Hello, Joni.
Hello.
And Michael Maddox, chair of the King County Young Democrats. Hi, Michael.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
And John Carlson, who drove over here from KVI Radio this morning. Glad to have you.
Morning.
But first, tonight in Manhattan, beg your pardon, tonight in Seattle, nearly 3,000 people are expected to sleep outside without shelter. The city's homeless count is nearly 20% worse than last year. In November, Seattle Mayor Ed Murray declared a state of emergency. He called for state and federal assistance. Well, now some help is on the way from the private sector. Amazon is turning one of its downtown properties into a temporary homeless shelter for families with children. The former Travelodge Hotel will house nearly 200 people for up to 1 year. I talked to Angel Gonzalez of the Seattle Times about this yesterday, and he described this as a classic win-win for Amazon.
They're bringing a lot of people into their literal home, which is, you know, South Lake Union downtown. It's like they're going to be in close proximity with their executives, with their employees. I think there's more than symbolic value to that. And at the same time, you know, it's sort of a typical Amazon thing, you know, something that's cheap. But effective, right?
Cheap, but effective. Amazon, it's not exactly known for its charitable ways. Joni, what did you think when you first heard this news about Amazon this week?
Well, I thought it was a very good idea. Why not? That building is sitting there. It's not going to be used for another year. Why wouldn't they do something for the community? They have a kind of a funky reputation in this town for not stitching themselves to the community. Their real estate guy, John Chetler, has recently signed on as chairman of the chamber, a volunteer position. But Amazon, you know, has some work to do. But as you said, or somebody said here just a second ago on that tape, you know, they're going to get a ton of great PR for not much money, not much investment.
Not much downside.
I heard them on national NPR talking about this. I mean, what a gimme here.
Yeah, it seemed to be an idea that kind of came out of nowhere. Michael, what did you make of it when you heard it?
I'm with Joni. I think this is a very nice gesture from Amazon, who is not well known for the philanthropic investments in the city of Seattle. And Mary's Place, who is going to be running this, this is part and parcel with some of the great work that they've been doing to identify buildings that aren't being used and provide safe shelter for our community members experiencing homelessness. I think it's important to remember this is, if I remember correctly, just 1 year that's going to be available before the property is going to be redeveloped. And I'm hopeful that Amazon will take a look at this model and see if they can incorporate that into some of their future construction in South Lake Union in the city to provide permanent stable housing for families in need.
John, how realistic do you think that is?
Don't know, but I love the model, not just what Amazon is doing, but how they're doing it. They are partnering with an organization that isn't there to serve the homeless. They are there to help repair the homeless. They're there to help get people back on their feet again. That's why Mary's Place exists. I've raised quite a bit of money for them over the air because their focus is on helping to get families back on their feet and back into housing. They're like the Union Gospel Mission. They're like the Salvation Army, groups that are really there to help people. And that means structure. And that means having in-house programs. It means looking at their situation in a comprehensive way. And that's what the city of Seattle in its homeless strategy hasn't done, which is why in an 11-year period, they have managed to spend literally hundreds of millions of dollars making the problem worse rather than, as they once promised to do, eradicating and ending homelessness in Seattle.
Well, we talked to the mayor earlier this week, and he seemed more than open to the idea of forming private-public partnerships, and he definitely thinks there's a role for some of our larger corporate citizens to play here. I mean, what's the extent of their responsibility, then, to solve this this very big problem in our region?
I think what they have is an opportunity. And again, I love this model of having corporations couple with homeless organizations that, again, are not just there to dispense services, but actually help homeless people get their lives together and get back on their feet. Because I think that's the best way to resolve this, whether it's a church partnering with a homeless organization, or it's a corporation, or it's a foundation. I love how they're doing this.
So the mayor has been very clear with everybody. He needs help from everywhere. He has asked for more state help. He got some, about $1 million from the state. He needs more federal help, and he's asked the business community to chip in too. It's a big problem. It's complicated. He doesn't have an easy solution. This is a good use of an empty building. It makes sense. You know, a lot of folks around here feel that Amazon is changing the city pretty darn rapidly. Amazon and other tech firms, to be completely fair. And so when people sit around grumbling in traffic, they maybe will have a different feeling. They say, well, at least Amazon's finally pitching in. Yay.
Michael, your thoughts?
No, I think that there is definitely an obligation for our for corporations in the city to participate in the solution of the homelessness crisis and to be invested in our community. You know, I think of a lot of the tax breaks that a lot of corporations seek to get in order to, you know, operate with more profit, while at the same time, that's what's costing us the ability to adequately invest specifically in the structures, the capital investment necessary to provide housing for people. I know that, you know, the mayor has actually been very good on this particular issue. We have the housing levy, for instance, that's going to really be focusing on the 0 to 30% area median income groups, but that does not, I mean, I think that every part of the community has a role to play, whether you're a corporation, whether you're an individual, whether you're a government nonprofit. Everybody should be chipping in. And, you know, really briefly, I was up in Snohomish County just yesterday, and Dwayne Lanes, their car dealership company, who is very invested in homelessness advocacy and shelters, particularly for young people, I think they set a good model that we can see more of here in Seattle.
So, you know, there's potential models there for private firms to get involved and be part of the solution. Meanwhile, the University of Washington, a public entity, is considering putting a tent city on their Seattle campus. Now, it's not a done deal yet, but the plan is calling for hosting 100 residents during the winter quarter of 2017. And that camp will be run by the group Share. The university says it will provide 24/7 security. They're also going to provide water and sanitation services. The president, Anna Marikause, says taxpayer and tuition funds will not be used. So is that a good idea for the university to host a tent city on campus?
I wholeheartedly support the work that Tent City Collective has done. I've worked with Hannah Alachich on this issue specifically. And really, I think when we look at the community support, the work that students and faculty have done to get the neighborhood councils around the university district to support this, almost all the elected officials who represent areas in and around the university district, including Rob Johnson from the Seattle City Council, you know, there's a lot of support for this because it's a Band-Aid measure. This is in no way a permanent solution, but we're not going to build housing for 3,000 people overnight. And having toured Tent City 3 and having helped set up some of the tent cities that are run by Lehigh, I can tell you that these are communities with children in them which are much safer options than what we have otherwise, which is sleeping under bridges.
You know, Joni, it strikes me as kind of an interesting visual there for incoming freshmen having a tour of campus. You know, here's the physics building and here's our tent city.
Yes. And so I'm of two minds on this, and they converge. So the first thing is that the mayor's own expert on homelessness said not a good idea to keep creating more tent cities, that it's especially hard on children. Think about that. But if we adopt your point here and say that we can't really get the housing cranked up so fast, the university model is a good one. So if you think about Seattle University years ago, hosted a tent city. I think it was for a quarter. And I've spoken to Father Steve Sundberg, the president of Seattle U, and he called the experience for everybody, well, for the students especially, enormously educational, and then talked about the other side. It's super good. It's one-stop shopping, if you think about it, for the homeless because they're on this university campus. And what are they getting? They have access to legal services, some kinds of health services. And it also sort of demystifies the whole relationship. I mean, you're on campus. You're seeing these people every day, just for a quarter, but just like you see your professors and your fellow students and the whole bit. But, you know, he called it a very, very positive experience for the university community.
John, do you see any downside to this, you know, loaning empty buildings, you know, Amazon's plan, putting up tent cities? You know, people get warm and dry for a limited period of time, but these are short-term solutions. Is that really where we should be focused?
Kim, I think they're completely different. I mean, the reason why I'm so optimistic about Mary's Place and Amazon in the old travel lodge on 8th Avenue is because it is not going to be a vertical tent city. Tent cities basically are just places for people to hang out. There are no real expectations. There are no, you know, drug or alcohol programs built in.
I'm not sure the residents there would agree with you on that.
Of course they wouldn't, but neither would the residents in the jungle. You know, this city has spent a phenomenal amount of money since 2005. And let's remember the fanfare. We were told in 2005 that the city was and county were going to end homelessness in Seattle. They built out their housing units. They spent an unprecedented amount of money. Did they end homelessness? No. Did they reduce it? No. Did they hold the line? No. They made it worse.
John, can you please look up and down the West Coast? You know, they did.
Yeah,
the other cities have the population has been expanding slash exploding up and down the West Coast, Hawaii. I mean, I don't think you can say that the people that came out with that very, you know, idealistic view made it worse. How would that be?
Yeah, and
well, look at the numbers.
I think it's also important to note that that was in 2005, and then in 2008 we had a recession, and we had significant divestment from the federal government and the state government into housing and other services.
Oh, actually, what we've had is an unprecedented amount of money, including a previous housing levy, an expansion of homeless services. This is an indication not that we're not spending enough money, but of how we're spending it. There are three ways to help the homeless. One of those ways will actually, like Mary's Place, like the Salvation Army, will actually help solve the problem. Other ways, like tent cities, won't do much harm, but won't do much good. No one's really going anywhere. And there are other ways that actually aid, abet, and encourage the problems that make people homeless, that exacerbate homelessness in the first place. I mentioned the Salvation Army. I mentioned the Union Gospel Mission. The Salvation Army's Adult Recovery Center, which is right there near the stadiums, have had empty beds, empty beds in their center for the last 10 years. Now, think about that.
Folks,
we have 3,000 people living on the streets and empty beds in the Salvation Army Adult Recovery Center.
Folks, this is a debate that we have talked about on our airwaves before. We will continue to talk about it in the future. We got started talking about Amazon and their news this week. And the University of Washington, they're going to make a decision on their tent city by the end of the academic year. You can share your thoughts by emailing regional@uw.edu. We'll be back in just a minute.
All right.
This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Kim Malcolm. Welcome back. We were just in the middle of a conversation about homelessness and the University of Washington considering putting up a tent city. I'm with Joni Balter, John Carlson, and Michael Maddox. And Michael, you had a thought. I wanted to make sure you get a chance.
Really quick. First, I just want to point out that the tent cities that are run by Lehigh and Cher do actually have requirements that you cannot drink or use drugs in the tent city, and you have to be participating in the community itself. A lot of the people who live there actually have jobs, and a lot of people do get placed into housing from the tent city, from the encampments across the city of Seattle. And I just want one final note, and that I think the Seattle Weekly pointed this out very well, that the expert that we hired as a city never even visited one of the tent cities before making the claim that those we shouldn't be doing anything with. I think it's a good interim measure that we're able to help provide immediate places for people to sleep tonight.
All right. The issue of homelessness, it continues here in Western Washington. And part of one of the core issues behind homelessness is mental illness and where they are treated and how they are treated. Which brings me to Western State Hospital, which is getting new leadership. Governor Jay Inslee fired the hospital CEO, Ron Adler, this week. He appointed Cheryl Strange to take over at the end of the month. This is to be the head of the state's largest psychiatric facility. And the firing came after a long string of negative headlines from Western State. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have repeatedly cited Western State Hospital over safety concerns. They've threatened to cut millions of dollars in federal funding. Workers and patients have been assaulted there. And last week, two patients described as dangerous escaped out a window. They were captured after a statewide manhunt. State lawmaker Lori Jenkins says Western State's problems are mostly centered around one thing.
At the very root of it, I think, is the fact that we don't have enough staff at Western State Hospital. We're not paying people enough money. And then we get into a circular problem of the lack of safety. Because we don't have enough staff, it's not safe, and then people don't want to come and work there.
So that's what Democrat Lori Jenkins thinks is behind this problem. John Carlson, do you agree with her?
Well, Cheryl has worked for the Department of Corrections. She's worked for the Department of Social and Health Services.
This is Cheryl Strange, the
Cheryl
CEO.
Strange, the new, newly announced. She's handled health benefits for SEIU, Service Employees International Union. I think it's going to take a whole lot more than a new manager. I think that Western State really needs a strong leader. I think they really need a whole new culture, because the Seattle Times had a brilliant takedown of the culture out at Western State in last Sunday's editions on the editorial page. Well worth reading. I'm guessing it was by Jonathan Martin because it was well researched. Just the way that place operates almost guarantees failure. And you had mentioned, Kim, assaults. One federal audit showed that within one four-month period, there was an average of four assaults a day on staff and on patients.
Correct.
Just incredible what is happening out there at Western State. So I think that Cheryl Strange has her work cut out for her. But again, I just think it's going to take more than a new person. I mean, they've changed the chief medical officer and several other officials out there. And in fact, they had recently changed their CEO a couple of years ago.
Well, it could be described as a chicken and the egg situation. They say they don't have enough funding.
Well, they actually just got 51, I think is the right number, of new nurses. No one knows. Is 51 the magic number? They need more staffing. They need security teams that go in and protect staff and patients. They need a system-wide security revamp. They got to redo it. Start with the windows, for sure.
Sounds like the windows need some work.
Start with the windows, every single window, and maybe somebody has to check windows on a regular basis, because the story was that they were sort of slowly getting these windows loose enough to break out of. They need a huge overhaul there. They need a huge culture change. Mm-hmm. The place is a mess.
Yeah, John Humbert has been doing some great work on this as well with Como 4, and I was actually talking with him about this to ask his opinion on it. And I think one of the things is they need a culture change, and how do you get there? It's going to take shaking up middle management. And as Representative Jenkins pointed out, it's also going to take ensuring that there's adequate staffing and that we're actually paying people what they're worth. You know, I think a lot of state employees went for years without any raise. And when you're not getting a raise, when you're understaffed and you're unsafe,
and you're scared to go to work,
yeah,
it doesn't fly.
And so I think that we need to do a much better job. And so hopefully Cheryl will be able, A, to start with that middle management shakeup and culture change, and B, be a better advocate in the legislature to get the adequate funding necessary to provide those safety measures, to put those capital investments in place to make it a safer facility.
Well, there hasn't been any major overhaul of their budget as of yet. So right now, Cheryl Strange has to pretty much work with what she's been given. What should be her top priorities, John?
Well, again, I don't think this is money. I think this is culture. I mean, if you put twice as much money into Western State with the way the place has been operating, the culture of intimidation and retaliation for employees who are trying to do their jobs and report things that are not working right, then you're just going to get a more expensive fiasco. You know, 1 in 9 positions out there are vacant. You know, 1 in 9 positions are unfilled out there. And
that's the biggest problem. That really is.
She needs to hire.
You think about, you know, who wants to build a career there right now, given how the reputation of Western State within the mental health community.
I mean, the number one priority that I think she's going to have is to ensure the safety of the residents at Western State Hospital. And then the how do you do that goes right back to filling those 1 in 9 positions and making it an attractive place. And that is going to require shuffling up of the middle management and bringing about that culture change.
And by the way, I think this really does start at the top. I think that this is something the governor himself should make a priority. It is that important and it is that neglected.
Well, you know, that brings me to a question about the governor and the leadership troubles that seem to have been dogging him, some would say. Ron Adler, he's not the first high-profile administrator who's lost their job under this governor. Back in February, of course, the head of the Department of Corrections stepped down, and Transportation Secretary Lynn Peterson was pushed out of her job. Not exactly fired, but she was ousted by Republicans. What do all these changes tell you about the leadership of the governor?
Well, I'll say the governor is having a really bad year. He seems feckless under a couple of scenarios. The shrug on charter schools, what was that? These department leadership issues. He doesn't seem like he's firing on all pistons here. It is a bad year to be doing it because it's an election year. That said, I don't know if that gets the voters up and over the Himalayas to the Republican candidate, Bill Bryant. That's a bigger climb.
Michael?
And specifically with Lynn, I mean, there's a situation where she had done amazing work with the Oso landslide, amazing work with the collapse of the bridge in Skagit County, and was implementing a plan of tolling on 405 as presented to her by the legislature, and then Republicans fired her for it because they're more interested in obstructing than actually governing in the state right now. But with the rest of them, I think what we are seeing is, we're seeing that the governor is stepping up and firing people who are doing a bad job and trying to bring new people in who will ideally do a better job and better manage taxpayer dollars and provide safe communities across the state.
Well, is the governor letting these leadership lapses go on too long? That's another question I've heard raised. John?
Well, I'll set the record straight on 405 here in just a minute. But the job of governor is difficult, but it's simple. A governor.
Wait a minute. You wanted this job.
Yeah. I'd say it is difficult, but it is
just
simple.
Just to say John Carlson ran for governor a few years
ago.
It
doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. You essentially have three things to do. The governor sets a course for the state of Washington. He hires women and men to carry out that vision, and he holds them accountable for performance. And I think a lot of people believe that on many of the major issues, a course has not been set. And if with many of the people who have been appointed to some of these major positions, there has not been accountability for what has happened.
Well, two points here. Lynn Peterson does not count as something that the governor did wrong. This was a little political battle that everybody knows was political. The Republicans were just in the mood to kind of go after Lynn Peterson, who I saw got a job yesterday in D.C. with something called, I think it was Smart Growth or Grow Smart,
yes.
Something like
and
that.
Any group with the name Smart in the title usually isn't, but go ahead.
yes, but firing somebody who makes a mistake, let's think about that. And let's, if we can, go back in history to Mayor Greg Nickels in the great snowstorm. He had a transportation leader who was not here during part of that snowstorm, who said flippantly, you know, no big deal, I don't drive a snowplow.
Right.
And a lot of people felt at that time if Greg Nickels had removed this person that he might have gotten his third term. And I don't know if he regrets it, but I know people around him were saying, are you kidding? If you had you're saying by keeping this person, that level of service is fine. Go ahead. We're digging it.
Right.
Can I talk 405 real quickly?
Go for it.
Okay, because back in 2005, Governor Gregoire talked the people of Washington State into swallowing a gas tax increase, 9.5 cents. And one of the things they were buying was a new lane of traffic to drive in on 405. A couple of years after people raised their gas tax to build this lane, legislature passes and the governor signs a bill to say, well, this isn't going to be a general purpose lane. This is going to be an HOV lane. So instead of three general purpose lanes and one HOV lane being turned into four lanes and one HOV lane, we're going to keep it at three and we're going to double the number of HOV lanes. So it'll be three and two, except that they redefined HOV status to mean three people in the car instead of two. So while they doubled the number of HOV lanes, they forced all the two-person carpools into the general-purpose lanes, deliberately creating traffic obstruction. And if you want to get out of the traffic jam, you have to pay a premium to drive on the lane that your gas tax paid for. That's why there was so much fury from people on the 405 corridor.
And Eastside drivers let their voices be known. And you could argue that that worked its way up the chain then.
And adios, Lynn Peterson.
But I don't know where you're going with this in terms of the governor's race, because you have to also discuss who's the 2016 electorate.
Well, we're not talking the governor's race. We're talking about the fury on 405. I think you could see some ledge races on the 405 corridor, Joni, flip as a result.
Yeah, but I don't think 405 equals governor's race is what I'm arguing.
I don't think any one issue does.
Well, the election is still a few months off, and there are a few vacancies to be filled at the top of some agencies. There's also some statewide offices where they don't have incumbents running for them. So the question I'm left with is, are the voters going to remember all this come November? This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Kim Malcolm, and the time now is 12:33. Well, we're moving on to the workplace now. And if you're a working white woman with no kids, you may have raised a glass of something bubbly to celebrate this past Tuesday. That's because on April 12th, you had officially made as much money as a man did by the end of 2015. If you're a woman of color, we'll have to celebrate with you a little later on this year. You're not going to earn as much money until this fall. Seattle journalist Ruchika Tolshian has been writing about pay equity at Forbes, specifically how to fix it. And earlier this week, she told me when women in the workplace speak up about getting a raise, they're seen as less likable, that they're pushy, and they're not team players.
A lot of the narrative around solving the gender wage gap is about asking women to negotiate their first salary or negotiate a salary raise. But then at the same time, if they're actually going to be penalized and punished for it, then we're not going to end up actually being able to solve the wage gap in any effective way. So I would say that it's really in the hands of managers and companies to solve the wage gap, not women.
So managers should solve this, not women. That's from Ruchika Tolshian. Michael, is she right? Should it be up to employers and companies to close the pay gap here between men and women?
Well, I think that we have laws on the books that require gender pay equity, and we need to actually enforce those laws. And I think that's fantastic that we have seen, for instance, the U.S. women's soccer team pointing out this significant disparity in their pay with the men's soccer team, even though they make more money for soccer than the men's soccer team does.
And better record, too.
And a much better record. And, you know, and locally, I think a big part of that is it is up to companies. And on that front, that means we do need companies and governments and to bring more people into higher level positions. People hire who they're comfortable with. And unfortunately, that has meant historically men tend to hire men for upper level positions and to bring them up through the ranks. And I think that, you know, in Seattle, we're making some good progress on that. I think our mayor has done some good work on that. We still have a lot more work to go.
So I'm not sure it's up to the companies to handle this, but it's certainly in their best interest, if you think about it. Because when you pay women better, they stay longer. You don't have to train people, less churn. It's better for the company. It's better all the way around.
Mm-hmm. There is we have a larger group of workers at the upper end of the age scale. They're getting ready to retire. The competition for talent among millennials, John, is pretty intense, and there are more female college graduates than men now. I mean, it would seem the onus would be on management now to solve this problem if they want their bottom line to improve over the long term.
Well, and the good news is the trend is going in the right way. You know, I mean, young as I look, I was actually in high school and college during the 70s and early 80s, right? And I remember.
I was just going to tell you how young you look.
Yeah. There was. Funny, Michael wasn't about to say that. Anyway, we used to see buttons back then worn on what was called Alice Doesn't Day. And the button said 59 because women only earned 59 cents for every dollar that a man earned doing full-time work. Now it's 79, and again, the trend is just going to continue.
It's actually lower in Seattle. That number is lower in Seattle.
In the city of Seattle. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about national trends. Mm-hmm. Because a growing, as the economy itself is changing from a muscle-driven economy to a brain-driven economy, as more and more young women are going into college, majority of undergrads and increasingly a majority of law school grads and even in business schools, you are going to see the needle continue to move in the right direction, which tells me the best thing we can do is encourage more economic growth and more entrepreneurial activity, because a growing number of people starting businesses are also women.
So I had this woman on Civic Cocktail last week, Liz Vivian from the Women's Funding Alliance, and she said the best lever to pull to help this, maybe it's just one of the best, but she cited it as the best, is to make sure that you provide paid parental and paid family leave, because women get caught in this and they end up not coming back to the workplace, having kids or taking care of parents. They end up not coming back to the salary that they kind of coulda, shoulda, woulda had. So that's something that that city government, state government can do.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we're working on in Seattle, and I think we've got a great council to push that through to get the city itself up to 12 weeks or more.
But that's just for city employees. San Francisco went for the businesses.
I think we can and should require businesses to do that and set up something akin to the L&I insurance program, where employers and employees both pay matching into a program so that everybody can have the opportunity for up to 12 weeks of paid family leave.
There was a very interesting study made of University of Chicago MBA graduates. And it was a 15-year study, not 1 or 2 years here or there. And over a 15-year period, beginning, I think, in the late 90s, 1 in 10 men who graduated from the MBA program was more likely, out of the workforce for 6 months or more. Guess what percentage of the women who graduated from the MBA program were likely to spend 6 months or more out of the workforce?
Well,
40%.
Yeah.
40% of the women. So by far a higher ratio. And of course, when you stop out of the workforce,
that's what I'm talking
it's
about.
Also gonna, right. It's also going to stall your momentum on the
exactly.
wage ladder.
Exactly.
Well, if you're at home looking after children, no matter what gender you are, you're going to make less money. So, John, is it the city's responsibility then to be a leader on this and to follow San Francisco's lead? Their law is businesses with more than 20 employees are providing 6 weeks of fully paid leave for new parents.
What I would like to see is just less onerous regulation of businesses, period, so that they can continue to grow and expand, and because that is the best way to reduce wage disparities is a growing economy. A growing economy is the friend of working women and for that matter, working men.
I just don't believe that if we leave it to the private sector that anything is actually going to get done. We've left it to the private sector and nothing has been done. And now it is the time. That's what we have got.
That's actually not true, because many companies are starting to do this in the tech world, especially because they can't get the talent. But to me, it doesn't hurt for the city to do it for itself, for the county to do it for itself, and for them to, you know, I wouldn't be opposed to a San Francisco-like call on the businesses.
You know, when we were thinking about this week, part of the one of the questions that came up for us was we wondered what kind of difference it would make if we didn't feel this social stigma around talking about what we actually make. Like, if we're supposed to be empowered walking into a salary negotiation of some kind, it helps to know what the folks around you are making. Why don't we even talk about this?
I think that we should. I think that, you know, Boston has done some great work on providing more transparency and salaries to in the private sector so that people can talk about what their salaries are. If my memory is correct, it's perfectly legal in the state of Washington for employees to talk about their salaries with their peers. This for me, that's where it comes. Organized labor is actually great, because when you have a labor union in place, everybody knows what everybody else makes, because there's a whole system in place that requires that. I mean, for me, that's the easiest, most capitalist way to do it, is to have more labor unions in force and workforces across the country.
Well, since women are notoriously bad at negotiating for themselves, more information certainly would be helpful. You will notice that in the last couple of weeks, Amazon and Microsoft came out with some numbers I'm wondering about some of the details of them, but they came out with some numbers that said that they are starting to pay or are now paying women as much as men in many of the job categories. In one case, I don't think they included managers. But they are mindful of this. Women need this information so they can do a better job on behalf of themselves. They always ask for less.
Which always goes back to the issue of retaining talent. And we have plenty of that in the room this morning. Joni Balter, Michael Maddox, John Carlson are with me here on The Week in Review. I'm Kim Malcolm. This is KUOW. You probably know Washington State is constitutionally required to adequately provide for K-12 or basic education. Right now, it's estimated we have to pony up $3.5 billion to pay for it. But where's that money going to come from? Over the past two decades, Washington's tax base has been declining. KUOW's business and economy reporter Carolyn Adolph looked into why.
The economy adds jobs and wealth, and sales tax revenues grow too, but only a little. This is one of the perils of running a state on a sales tax, because people's spending habits have changed. They buy more on the internet, and they pay less state sales tax.
That gap just gets bigger and bigger every year.
This is James McIntyre, Washington State Treasurer, who has been staring at our shrinking pile of revenue for years. If it wasn't for our eroding tax base,
we'd have another $15 billion in the state treasury to be used for education and health care and other social services.
Washington's economic growth means, among other things, more people. The state has 100,000 more school-age children to educate than it did in 1995.
So there we have it. More kids in school and less tax revenue to pay for them. That was from KUOW's Carolyn Adolph. Carolyn also reported this. If Washington had Oregon's income tax system, we'd collect $9.6 billion more per fiscal year than we do now. So, once again, this question, and we have discussed this before on Week in Review, is it time for Washington to ditch the sales tax and bring in a state income tax to pay for these declining, to make up for these declining revenues and pay for things that people care about, basic education and mental health services? John?
Somewhere there is a public radio station in Oregon right now convening a panel talking about whether it's time to ditch the Oregon system
exactly.
And adopt the consumption tax model. Boy, we've been hearing this for a long time. First of all, a quick clarification. We don't have declining money here in Washington
State. I was waiting
for
John to say that. I wanted him to say it. I knew he had the number.
We just raised state spending last year. We just raised the state budget three times higher than the rate of inflation. You don't do that with declining money because you have to bring your budget into balance here in Washington State. So, you know, the problem we have here in Washington State might be how we're spending our money. Yeah, I notice when it comes to education, we now spend about 40-43% of our personnel money on people who aren't in the classroom. But to say that we don't have money to spend, of course we do.
John, the sales tax is regressive. The poor here in Washington State, they pay nearly 17% of their income in state taxes. For the rich, it's far less, around 2.4% or so. So isn't there an argument to be made that the state income tax is simply more fair?
Well, there is. You just made it. And it's a fair point. However, this also went to the polls, Kim. Just 6 years ago, we not only had an income tax on the ballot, but it was an income tax strictly aimed at the 1%, households earning $500,000 a year or more. We had a wonderful spokesman for that cause in Bill Gates Sr.
Who had to go in the dunk tank.
Went into a dunk tank.
For an ad. That was the best moment of the whole campaign. This big, huge guy diving for the income tax.
I still remember that commercial. Yes.
That was great.
And it was amply funded. And it went down by 33 percentage points. When voters say no to an idea by 33 percentage points, that is what is called a hint.
Well, beyond the hint. So the situation is this. This fight with us in Oregon, it shall be forevermore, if you think about it. So the reason voters here will not go, I thought it was 60-40, but I'll take John's numbers there. We vote no on an income tax because no one here in this state believes it's not plus. It's not plus the sales tax. So, yes, they would, quote, ditch, that's what you said, ditch the sales tax for about 10 minutes. And then the next year they would start ratcheting it back up. And everybody has already figured this out, which is why they won't do it. And the same story applies to Oregon on the same front. They will not add an income tax because they will not add the sales. Wait a minute, I'm getting this backwards. They will not add the sales tax because they think that it's plus their income tax. And they think that it'll just come creeping back up just the way it always goes.
It sounds like some therapy may be required here. It sounds like all
Indeed.
These voters have some serious trust issues.
Yeah. Oh, and on the underlying question, it makes absolutely no sense that we maintain the most regressive tax structure of any state in the United States. And it is time for us to implement a progressive income tax to challenge Colleton v. Chase, the 1933 case that defined income as property, which we are the only state Supreme Court who has ever done that, and do so in a way that can instill trust with the voters. And that means ditching the state portion of the sales tax, working to identify other tax reform measures so that we actually are seeing the people who are paying 17% of their income see a tax reduction, the folks who are paying 10% of their income into state and local taxes see a reduction, and the people who are paying 2.2%, the highest income earners, see an increase in their tax liability in the state of Washington. And then from there, we can finally start moving away from having to fund things by levy after levy after levy, which is what we are seeing here in Seattle. We're seeing it in fire districts across the state. It's not a sustainable model. And yes, revenue might be going up from our main tax sources in the state of Washington, but the actual expenditure need for things like education, public safety, health and human services are going up at a much faster clip because of the growth of our state. And we cannot, it's not a sustainable model that we have in place right now.
The income tax is more fair way to go. But I'm telling you that the history here makes that so hard to get to.
And I mean, voters also voted down charter schools. And then they came back and voted for charter schools. And so I think that there's definitely room.
Well, not by 33 points. I mean, it was always a very close call. And, of course, the pro-charter school forces were always hopelessly outspent by the Washington Education Association, the state teachers union. And they defied the union and voted charter schools back in. And, of course, they've been trying to dismantle them ever since.
Yeah. I mean, but even on that note, the 1% rule, the Tim Iman rule on property tax increases year over year, barely passed in the same year we passed a reduction of class sizes and increases in teacher salaries. And the state legislature had no problem putting that back into place, even though it was found unconstitutional. And that has continued to lead to the significant reduction in revenue for local school districts, for local cities, for counties, and for the state of Washington as a whole.
You know, it sounds like the state is just, it's been divided for quite some time on this issue. And the McCleary decision, you know, there is a deadline that the legislature is running up against. The Supreme Court has said that the McCleary ruling around basic education funding, that has to be met by 2018. Is that going to be the catalyst to bring people to some kind of new understanding over taxes and revenue in the state of Washington?
I think it's far more likely that what you will see is that some of the loopholes will be closed to make sure that we get at more online revenue. Other loopholes, I really don't see the legislature doing something that the voters said no and no and no.
I think one thing that might happen, I was talking with David Goldstein about this, and one of the laws that was overturned by the state Supreme Court, I believe, in 1952, that implemented it wasn't overturned, it was just ruled unenforceable at that point, that implemented a flat income tax, is still technically on the books. And so it would be interesting to see if our state Supreme Court be willing to do a writ of mandamus, directing the governor to actually begin collecting on that tax that's already there.
John, can we come together? Can there be a kumbaya moment?
No. No, it's a good, robust, honest disagreement over priorities and over whether the people of Washington State are overtaxed. You know, this is very much a Democratic-leaning state. We see that every year since 1988 in the race for president. Yet we have, you know, a Republican state Senate, and we have almost a 50-50 House. We're one vote away from that.
I wouldn't get too smug about that with Trump at the top of the ticket.
Well, part of
just a little thought there.
But part of the reason for where we are right now is because I think the voters, as Democrat inclined as they are, don't want to see their taxes raised. They believe that the state of Washington is not spending their money as responsibly and as efficiently as they ought to.
Michael, I'll give you the last word.
Oh, I mean, I think what we really need is legislators in Olympia who are interested in taking the political hit necessary to actually do meaningful, big-time revenue reform in the state of Washington so we can move away from this regressive system and move toward a more progressive and stable revenue structure so we're no longer in situations like we have with McCleary in the future.
That was Michael Maddox. I'm Kim Malcolm. This is The Week in Review on KUOW. Well, we're just 2 weeks into the regular Major League Baseball season, and already the Seattle Mariners are off to a rough start. They're second from the bottom in the American League West with a record of 3-6. It's too early, people will tell you, to say if they're going to be stuck in the basement all year. But here's something we do know. The Seattle Mariners have the least loyal fan base of all Major League Baseball teams. That's according to the consulting firm Brand Keys, who say the M's have been steadily falling in the loyalty ranking since 2001, the last year they made the playoffs. So, folks, what's your personal policy on this? When things are dark and bleak, is that when, as a true fan, you're supposed to dig in and support your team no matter what? Or should you just walk away until they're good again?
I would just say that the Mariners have big-time Seahawks envy, that they want to be the Seahawks, but they're not putting the same or even a similar product on the field. You know, this, I'm going to date myself here, but a long-ago owner of the Seattle Mariners made fun of baseball in Seattle. His name was Jeff Smullyan, my nemesis for a couple of reasons. And he made fun of just the idea. He wanted to take the team to Tampa at the time, didn't have a team. And he made fun of this place. He said we were too busy hiking, biking, swimming, sailing, and all of that, which we proved was not true. When they put a winning product on the field, folks went out. When you see what happened, we're talking about a performance collapse over the weekend here in front of, as the weekend ran on, 100,000 fans. That is a turnoff. And we do have other options here. We're not like some of the other cities that we're being compared to. I'm from Pittsburgh, where, you know, baseball's the only reason to live in some cases.
Michael, where do you come down on this? Do you walk or do you stay?
As a Little League umpire, I prefer going to Little League games. But, you know, I enjoyed a game at the park. But I think one of the issues that the Mariners run into is that they don't have that same connection with the community that they used to in the Jay Buhner and Ken Griffey Jr. days. And that's a complete, you know, as Joni pointed out, we have other options who are very in the community all the time. The Seattle Reign, the Storm, the Majestics, the Seahawks, the Sounders. These are teams that really incorporate Seattle into what they do. And the Mariners just haven't seemed to do that. And then since the 2016 season, they're very, very good at losing, especially home opener games, which is a real downer when you're trying to be a fan.
John, what do you say? Are Mariners fans who are walking away, are they disloyal or are they just smart consumers?
Guys, we did win the other night. I mean, you know,
there was that one win. Yes, please don't
season. The season's not quite over.
No,
on April 15th. Wow. And by the way, Michael, my hat goes off to you. You're a Little League umpire. That can be perilous work.
I'll say.
No, I did some Little League coaching myself. And I gotta tell you, I think that I disagree a little bit with this report, because if you look at fan attendance, you know, the Mariners, I think, are in the top half of attendance. And so, you know, for a team that
we're in the top half. What I'm getting at is, so they had 100,000 people over the weekend, and by Monday night or Tuesday night, whatever it was, they were down to 13, which is a weekday, I guess.
Yeah, it's a weekday.
Yeah, but they stunk up the joint. There was that.
But no, of course, when your record gets better, you're going to have, you know, more behinds in the seats, right? You're going to have more people showing up. But I do think the Mariners have a solid fan base. And again, I think that if you look at, you know, last year's attendance, the year before that, we didn't lead the league in attendance, but we weren't way down there towards the bottom. And to me, fan loyalty means that you simply stop showing up.
Well, people have described Seattle fans as bandwagoners. And I'm just, you know, you can imagine like a typical Red Sox fan, you know, listening to us and looking at our loyalty rankings after, you know, four generations of a family cheering for the same team. They're just laughing in their Sam Adams beer at us. I mean, are we bandwagoners? Is that deserved?
For the Mariners, yes.
Especially no. For the Mariners.
Yeah. No, I think that my sister's a diehard fan, and she goes to every opening game and goes to a lot of games throughout the season. So I think we do have our diehard fans. But generally, I think for the Mariners, until they start winning again, until Kyle Seager learns how to field a ball, we're going to be in a position where we're going to be a lot of bandwagoners.
Look, you know, as I see it, this is a brand new team, okay? We've got a new manager, Scott Service. We got a new general manager, Jerry DePoto. Half our players are new. So, you know, let's see what happens. This could be the first year of rebuilding. We're seeing it out at the University of Washington Husky football program under Chris Peterson. So, you know, let's try and be at least a little bit optimistic the third week in April. I mean, we have a long way to go, you guys.
Hope springs eternal, John.
Yeah. Well, listen, if I can root for the Seattle Pilots,
that's
back in 1960, then I can root for the Mariners.
It is spring in Seattle, and the Seattle Mariners are on the road. They're in New York this weekend. They're taking on the Yankees this afternoon. First pitch is at 4:05 our time. I want to say thank you to our panel today. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail, Michael Maddox, the chair of the King County Young Democrats, and John Carlson, morning host on KVI. I'm Kim Malcolm. Bill Radke will be back next week. Have a great weekend.